And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. I do it quite often on this show. That is, take myself out of my intellectual comfort zone. I do it because I hope that I'm not too old to learn new things, at least things that are new to me. And I want to appeal to the interest and curiosity of as many of you listening as possible. Quantum and cybersecurity are two such areas. And my bet is that many, no, most of you, know that they are both important, but would have difficulty engaging fully in a conversation about why they're important. Now, my guest today is one of Geneva's leading lights in these two important fields. His highly impressive CV is too long to do justice to now, but let me just give you a flavor. Bootstrapping, 20 years ago, startup creation, initial creation and licensing with the University of Geneva, developing and launching first products, single photon detectors, and QRNG. I wonder how many of you listening out there know that that stands for quantum random number generation. Did you know that? He's also a non-executive director of the Co-op Group in Basel many years, and it's a joint venture company in Hangzhou, China, which he established the IDQ to develop, manufacture, and commercialize QKD, quantum key distribution, in the Chinese market. He has a PhD from the University of Geneva in physics for research in the field of quantum optics and quantum communications, and degrees and diplomas from the University of Lausanne, from the EPFL and Carnegie Mellon University, Pittsburgh, in the United States. He speaks all the Swiss languages, and I'm going to ask him if that includes Romansh, plus some Japanese. Grégoire Ribéry, CEO of ID Quantique, welcome to the McKay Interview, and thanks so much for inviting me to your offices here in Lancy-Pont-Rouge, part of Geneva.
Thank you, Michael.
It's great to see you again. Listeners, before we start, for those of you not familiar with Geneva, Pont-Rouge is an old industrial part of the city which, over the past 10 to 15 years, has had new life breathed into it and been transformed into a modern and thriving tech business quarter. Now, Grégoire, I seek your sympathetic understanding today when I say that our task is to put into simple and non-technical language the bigger picture of what your business sector does that makes our lives better, and within that bigger picture, what your company, ID Quantique, does that enables the business of your clients and sustains the lives of your employees. So tell me first what the larger scene of the industry in which you work looks like, how it touches the lives of ordinary folk, like me, for example, and many of our listeners who have good educations but do not have PhDs in quantum physics or computer technology. What's the big picture, Grégoire?
Very good question, Michael. The you know, quantum physics is the physics that was invented in the first 10, 20 years of the 20th century by people like Einstein, Bohr, Planck. And so it was a completely new physics. And for the first few years, it remained just theoretical, just some ideas on paper. And after World War II, there was a first quantum revolution where quantum physics was put into use and led to very useful things such as semiconductors, lasers, and other technologies like this. And somehow we can say that IT technology, you know, telecom, computers, are the product of this first quantum revolution.
So that's already 70 years old.
That's already, exactly. Yeah. But with this first quantum revolution, people or technologies were using quantum physics as an ensemble, you know, lots of quantum objects at the same time. So you don't unleash the full power of quantum physics. And what started in the late 90s was the second quantum revolution, where with advance in technology, in research, it allowed researchers to work with individual quantum objects. And these quantum objects have very special properties that allow to do new things. And
for example?
So there are really three areas that people are researching. Quantum computing, building faster computers, exploiting these quantum properties. Quantum communications, secure communications using quantum physics. And then quantum sensing, to measure some properties with the highest accuracy possible.
I see. Now tell me, where and how ID Quantique fits into this broader picture, or to use the fashionable word, the ecosystem. Where does your company fit into this big picture?
So maybe I should first talk about quantum computing. We are not doing quantum computing, but it sets the scene. And quantum computing, as I mentioned, will allow to build faster computers. That's great. We'll be able to simulate certain problems that are not, that cannot be simulated today, invent new materials, better batteries, so lots of applications. There is a dark side to quantum computing, which is that this revolutionary quantum computing power will allow to break the cybersecurity that we use today. You know, cybersecurity is based on cryptography and on the fact that certain calculations take too much time today with today's computers. Mm-hmm. With new quantum computers, adversaries or bad people will be able to do these calculations very efficiently and break the cryptography that we use today. That's where IDQ comes into play, because we have a solution that allows to secure information and communication, not based on mathematics, on computing power, but on the laws of physics. The fact that the laws of physics prevent data interception and the laws of physics, they don't change, you know, they don't depend on what your adversary can do.
And why is this service that you provide so important? I mean, is it a crowded space with lots of competitors? And for example, if I put the question in a very odd way, supposing you weren't there, what would happen? What special space do you occupy which is so valuable to those who use you?
Yeah. You know, so it's interesting. We started the company in 2001, just when I came out of University of Geneva with three co-founders. And, you know, in retrospect, I think I can say we started too early because the market was not ready. The technology was really barely working. If you look, we were probably in the top three first quantum technology startups. And so for a long time, it was very lonely out there. You know, we're probably the only company doing quantum technologies. The other two...
So people were watching you maybe to see if you'd fail.
So yes, and at the same time also, the people doing research, you know, they always need justification for their research when they apply for a grant. So they always said, oh, look, there's ID Quantique, you know, so what we do is actually useful. So and I think things started to change in 2015, 2016.
What happened then?
With an acceleration of research in the field. And I think two things can be mentioned. One is that Google started a program in quantum computing. So somehow it went out of the academic field to become an industrial research field. And, you know, you can imagine when Google does something,
of course,
that they have deep pockets, they can do it seriously. And the second thing is that in the US, the NSA, the National Security Agency, which kind of looks at what people use in terms of information security, they said, oh, watch out, be careful, quantum computing is coming, and we need to change the way we do cryptography, we secure information.
So this is a general warning from the federal department.
Exactly. And so this kind of changed everything. Venture capital started pouring into the field, and so there is now quite a bit of effort, probably a few hundred startups worldwide, working in these three fields of quantum computing, communication, and sensing. So I would say, you know, it's been lonely for a long time. Now we have competition. Market is growing, so it's an exciting new phase for us.
I see. So I'm still going to persist with my request for you to help me with my education.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
When we first met at the British Swiss Chamber of Commerce in Geneva a few months ago, you used many mysterious phrases, at least they were mysterious to me, like quantum key distribution systems, like quantum safe network encryption, you've touched on that already, like single photon counters and hardware random number generator. And these are the four that I seem to remember. Let's take them one by one, Gregoire. Just for starters, complete the jigsaw of my understanding of a complex and unfamiliar field. What is quantum key distribution system? Give me an example, or the listeners that we can understand listening to you.
So it's a technology that allows secure communications on optical fibers. So typically optical fibers are the pipes that organizations use to transmit data, and it's a new way to encode information in these pipes that allows high security. Now, let me take a very simple image.
Okay.
You know, you can think of a communication link as a tennis game.
Okay.
The emitter takes a tennis ball, writes a message on the ball, sends the ball across, and then the receiver catches the ball, reads the message.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge is that someone could be in the middle, you know, an adversary,
catch the ball,
read the message, and then send the ball on. And you know, in practice, you may not be able to notice this. And so that's the way normal communication systems work. And so what we do in quantum is we replace the tennis balls with soap bubbles. And a soap bubble, it's fragile.
Yeah.
If someone tries to intercept it, to touch it, make it burst, and so the communication is perturbed and you can detect this perturbation.
But the message would be lost if the bubble
message
burst.
Is lost, but at least you know that there's an alarm and you know that you should stop, that you should be careful.
Okay.
And so that's the idea. So, of course, no one uses tennis balls and soap bubbles.
Sure.
The tennis balls in modern networks are actually pulses of light that contain millions of grains of particles of light called photons. And so someone that wants to intercept communication can take a few of these photons, read the message without perturbing most of the photons. And that's why you have this inherent vulnerability. What we do, our soap bubbles, are individual photons, one by one.
This is the single photon.
And that's a single
counter,
photon, which you need to be able to detect, so that's a receiver. And a single photon is a quantum object. You know, it's described by the laws of quantum physics. And in quantum, there's this principle, maybe you've heard about it, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
No, I haven't. Tell me.
It says that in quantum, no matter how hard you try, you cannot observe, measure something without perturbing it. It's fundamental. You measure, there's a perturbation.
You disturb it a little bit.
Yeah. Just measuring means perturbation. Yeah. You know, it's not, you cannot observe something passively. Yeah. That's fundamental. You know, it puzzled Einstein and people like this, but in the end, it's the way the world works.
So that is a law of physics.
So it's a law of physics. And so we use this, you know, just like if you touch a soap bubble, you make it burst. If you observe a photon, you perturb it, and we can see this perturbation. That's the idea. That's quantum key distribution. So what we do is we send these single photons. We detect them. That's the single photon detector. And that allows to have long-term security based on the laws of physics, because, you know, the security comes from the laws of physics, and so that's the quantum safe, in a sense. So you're safe against anything. That's, I guess, the three terms.
What about the old saying that if a man can make it, a man can break it?
Yeah.
Do the laws of physics still transcend that?
Mm-hmm. So it's different, you know.
It's not the same.
But the world of quantum is different. It's really that you take advantage of a fundamental principle to ensure security. So, and that's the beauty of the technology, and that's why there are high expectations on this technology.
I see. So it's fascinating. Well, my guest today is Grégoire Ribaudy. He's the CEO of ID Quantique. In fact, he's one of its creators and founders, and we're in his office in the heart of Geneva. Grégoire, let's look at what you do from a slightly different angle. If I ask you this very simple, maybe naive question, what does privacy mean? How can we protect it? And what, in your opinion, what in your experience, are the important distinctions between commercial privacy and personal privacy?
Yeah. So let me start by the angle that, you know, to protect privacy in the world of technology, you need a set of technology called cryptography. And cryptography is a way to hide information from someone that is not allowed to access it. So, and it's a very fundamental technology that you use every day. You know, every time you connect to your online banking site, you connect, you type HTTP and S means secure, and it's secure because there is some kind of cryptography. So it's a very important technology that allows to ensure security of the information, whether it's security for commercial means, but also privacy. I guess it's very important that this technology works. You know, we cannot. It's the foundation.
Yeah.
If we cannot use this foundation, then we will not be able to deliver services in the digital world. And right now, with the progress in quantum, there might be there will be new attacks, which means that we may have to completely change the way we do cryptography, the kind of security that we do, and we may lose privacy. That's a very important topic. You know, on the one hand, it may mean that you cannot do online banking anymore, which of course is very important, because our society today relies so much on everything digital.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so there's this aspect, but there's also the aspect that from a personal point of view, private point of view, we may not be able to ensure privacy in the digital world, and may have to resort to old approaches to...
I was going to say, I mean, people like you who have that particular kind of education, and now, because of your experience, have a longer view. I mean, you must have a plan B and a plan C, surely. Yeah. Or are you telling me that plan B actually means going backwards?
No. The plan B is working, is what we're doing, so that to allow to upgrade the infrastructure. So that's really the idea. That's what we're working on, is to develop a set of solutions that will still be available in case there's this development. Now, in terms of privacy, I have a slightly cynical also view, is that people don't really care about privacy, you know, unfortunately.
Isn't that a generational thing, though? I mean, from my generation, I'm a bit older than you, but also you're not a young man anymore. You've bridged that period where we did have privacy. We had to go to a telephone box to make a phone call and not have the thing on the table, whereas our children have just grown up with it. So maybe it's a different way of looking at things.
It is. Maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned. But I think
Me too.
but I think, you know, in the digital world today, it's impressive how some people, how much information they share online. And, you know, so you may ask, you know, do we actually need privacy in today's world? I don't know.
So it's a philosophical question, isn't it?
Societal question.
You're still thinking about...
But nevertheless, I mean, for the infrastructure, for the way our society works from an infrastructure point of view, we do need cryptography. So the aspect where it's more about authentication of who is sending a message, to ensure that if you turn on a power plant remotely, it's really you're allowed to do this. And that's fundamental.
Or a weapon system. A very bad example.
And everything, you know, traffic lights, lots of things. So that's fundamental to the way our society works today.
Now, this may sound like an odd question, but I'm sure you'll understand. We're in Geneva, so in a way it's not so unusual. We're not far, where we're sitting now, from Villa Diodati. Mm-hmm. In 1816, all those years ago, Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. Now, taking the theme of her famous and timeless book, and with the present debate about AI buzzing all around us, I have to ask you, Gregor, are we still in control? You've already hinted a little bit that we might not be. Mm-hmm. Or have we merely created a modern-day Frankenstein which will demonstrate at some point a will of its own? I mean, what's your view on that?
I think we're still in control. You know,
we're still in control.
We still have the option to switch off, but we have to be very careful, because at some point it may not be the case anymore. And but that's the debate about the good side and bad side of technology is fundamental to science and technology in general. I mentioned earlier quantum computing. It will be extremely useful to solve many problems that we have today. Better batteries, maybe carbon capture, lots of things like this.
But when you say that, there's a lot in what you just said. Is that because of the speed at which we can do those calculations reasons?
Yeah. The speed, but also the fact that certain calculations, they just require too much power with a classical computer. So fundamentally, they're not tractable using a classical computer, but will be with a quantum computer.
I see. Okay.
Because simulating the microscopic world is not efficient with a traditional computer. The microscopic world is quantum, and so simulating it with a quantum device is kind of makes sense and is the way to do it efficiently. So you know, good application, positive application, but also I mentioned the one breaking cybersecurity, which is also a negative application. I think in general we have to we'll as human beings, we always face with ethical choices, and that's our nature, they're not always easy to make these choices.
Maybe this is an unfair question to ask, but in your experience, and I mean, you've been doing this now, you have PhD, you've been working for more than 20 years, so you have a long view. How important is it, in your experience, that the general population know about what you're doing, and do you understand why there's an anxiety amongst many people about cybersecurity and AI in this case? And is that anxiety justified, do you think, amongst the general population?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's extremely important that people understand more science, you know. Mm-hmm. And for me, what happened during COVID around vaccines was a bit of an eye-opener, because for me, you know, a vaccine is a clear positive result of science, of hundreds of years of science. And somehow the fact that people started questioning and having theories about the fact that you could have, I don't know, 5G chips and vaccines and things like this. For me, and I think, you know, it's very important that scientists engage in a dialogue with people. And I must say, I don't really understand why this connection got lost somehow between the general public and the scientists. But it's very important to engage more and more. And so it's going to be the same, you know, 5G. Also, there was a big question. People started saying, oh, we don't want 5G antennas. But of course, they are the ones that use their smartphone all the time. And what's interesting also is to compare a bit the attitude in different places in the world. You know, in Asia, there's still a very optimistic approach to technology, the fact that it will bring solutions, whereas in Europe, in the US, I'm not so sure, but in Europe, there's a bit of a pessimistic view on technology. And I'm not saying we should be naive, you know, about technology. We need to ask questions, but nevertheless, a bit more optimism. Maybe, you know, there's always this question. In the US, they try things first and regulate afterwards. In Europe, we regulate first. And yes. So I'm not sure it's the best approach.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. But you've led me right into a question that I often ask of people with scientific backgrounds. When I talk to them about Switzerland and education, is there, in your experience, an uptake, an increase in the number of young people studying mathematics and sciences in schools and universities? Would you encourage it? And you hinted that you would. Or would you encourage young people to have a broad liberal education and then specialize at postgraduate level? Before you answer me, let me put the question another way, Gregor. What should young people learn today?
Well, I think, you know, they should learn what interests them first and
so
foremost.
So what the heart tells them.
Exactly.
Interesting, exactly. Then.
I do hope that a lot of them will be interested by science and engineering and mathematics. A couple of weeks ago, I saw in Le Temps, there was an article about the trends in the various sections of universities
and in Switzerland.
It was interesting to see that in general all the STEMs, you know, science, technology, engineering, they were going up.
Really?
Since the 90s, when I was in university, they kind of doubled the number of people studying physics, math, and I think that's positive.
Well, that's significant.
Yeah, exactly. And I wasn't. If you had asked me before this article, I would have said, "Oh, not enough people go into this." Now it's true that we would need more and more, because that's an area where there's a lot of work to be done, you know, with the new technologies. But so I think it's great that young people are interested in science, math in general.
But they shouldn't come into it too early.
No, I think you're right. I kind of like the Swiss system.
I'm asking,
system.
I
agree. I think I kind of like the Swiss system, the maturité, which is quite broad, yeah. Up to, 19 years old?
Yeah.
And then you go into university and you specialize. I think it's a good approach.
Okay, that's good. Well, we've come almost to the end of our conversation, but I've got to ask you something topical. Really topical, because it's only happened in the last few weeks. When you look at the staff revolt, and I take a quotation from this morning's Financial Times over Sam Altman's ousting and this whole ChatGPT thing, what do you see behind it? I mean, I'm sure when you read an article like that, knowing what you do, being in the industry, you see things that ordinary people like me wouldn't. What's going on in this?
Yeah,
people just move to another company like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I honestly have no idea what really happened there at OpenAI. There are interesting things. One is the fact that there is a shortage of labor. So somehow, if people move, that has an impact. You know, finding the specialist in AI today, there's a limited number of these people.
So they have value.
They have a market value. It can have an impact. So they can vote with their feet somehow, yeah. by moving. What's also interesting is the fact that you have someone that seems to be a visionary. You know, of course, I don't know much about this Altman, but he's a visionary, and he goes where he has the resources to put his vision into practice.
And people follow him.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I see similar things in other fields. Now, you always have to be a bit careful because sometimes people that have grand visions and goals, you know, what do they really want?
No, I can understand that. I mean, you know, we know that man is full of weaknesses and strengths, and we have to be very careful on that. Gregor, thanks so much for answering all my questions. I certainly know a lot more now than I did half an hour ago. My guest today has been Gregor Ribaudy, the chief executive of ID Quantique, the brilliant quantum and cybersecurity company. Thank you, Gregor.
Thank you, Michael.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.